1 Corinthians 9:1 through 9:14, the 24th talk in a series on 1 Corinthians, was presented by Ron Julian on July 27, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We are in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 this morning. Paul has been addressing the issue of meat sacrificed to idols, and I've been trying to argue that that is a relevant issue to us, at least the implications of it that Paul brings out. The problem is that in Corinth there's been a disagreement. Some of them say we have the freedom to eat this meat, and others have been saying no, we don't, it would be wrong to eat the meat. We've seen sort of three themes so far emerge from what Paul has said in chapter 8. First of all, on the one hand, there is only one God who is ultimately not concerned about religious restrictions on food. The meat-eating group in Corinth is right. There are no idols, so meat sacrificed to idols is no big deal, and it's fine to eat, on the one hand. Secondly, though, nevertheless, they are in the wrong in the way they have been exercising this right to eat the meat, because in their arrogance and unconcern for the other believers around them, they have been putting pressure on less mature believers to do what they believe to be wrong. So they have been giving no thought to what the implications are of exercising this freedom that they have. And this all is an example of the relationship between knowledge, on the one hand, especially knowledge about religious freedom, and love. That it is not enough to merely know that I have the right to do something. I have to think about whether my actions are actually working for the benefit of other people. That's what Paul has been talking about in chapter 8. Now, as we turn to chapter 9, it might seem that we're going on to a new topic, or that Paul has totally jumped the rails or something, because he starts ranting about how he's an apostle and he has a right to get paid. Might seem like we have sort of barged in on some ancient contract negotiations or something here, but no. We're basically on the same topic. Chapters 8, 9, and 10 are all related to each other, all basically about the same thing, I would argue. So let me give you the basic idea of what we're going to see in chapter 9. Having been talking to them about, on the one hand, their right to eat the meat, but on the other hand, their need to think about the implications of how they use their freedom on other people, Paul in chapter 9 is going to turn to himself and the way he exercises his freedom as a human being, as an apostle in particular. So, Corinthians have a right to eat this meat, but they have to consider the impact of their actions on other people. Well, Paul has rights too. As an apostle, he, to be specific, has the right to be financially supported by the Corinthians. But Paul has considered the impact of exercising that right on the Corinthians, and he has decided not to exercise it. And he wants to use this as an example to the Corinthians as to how they ought to think about the exercise of rights. So, just like I said before, there is kind of a two-part point that Paul is making. Before he said, yes, in theory you have a right to eat the meat, but no, in practice in this situation it would be unloving to do so. Now in his analogy he's going to say, yes, in theory, I have the right to be supported financially by the Corinthians, but in practice, I have decided not to do it out of love. That's what his example is going to be in chapter 9. So you have to understand this structure to see where Paul is coming from here. He starts out talking about what we're going to see today is the section where he talks about his right to be paid. But you have to understand that he's talking about his right to be paid only so that he can turn around and say, I have not exercised that right, and here's why I have not exercised that right, and this is the way you ought to think about how you exercise your rights. But today we're going to look at the first half, that part where he's saying, I have a right to be paid for what I do by you guys. Okay? I hope that's clear. So he starts out saying, am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? If to others I am not an apostle, yet certainly I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. So, hopefully my little introduction helps you to see where this seemingly out of left field statement comes from. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? He's saying, look, we've been talking about your freedoms and the way you exercise your freedom. Well, I want to turn to myself as an example. I have freedoms, don't I? I have rights. Am I not an apostle? And by implication, what he wants to say is, doesn't that give me certain rights as an apostle? Are I not free? Am I not free to do certain things? And we'll see what he means as he goes along. But we need, Paul needs in this situation, to emphasize this idea that he's an apostle. Because if you remember back, you probably won't, but when we were looking in the first part of 1 Corinthians, we saw that Paul has a very troubled relationship with the Corinthians, and many of them there aren't sure what they think of him. Some of them even so far as denying that he is truly an apostle at all. Paul had this problem on a number of fronts because he wasn't a part of the original 12, and because in some senses he stood apart from the other apostolic community. He didn't work with the other apostles a lot. Jesus called him to this ministry to the Gentiles, and there was a lot of turmoil. People who said, no, Paul doesn't know what he's talking about, or, well, Paul's okay, but you need to move on from Paul and get in with the real guys, or, you know, that sort of thing going on. So, Paul wants to make this analogy. Say, look, here's how I have exercised my freedom, but he sort of has to get in first to strongly make the case that he does have this right that he says he is deciding not to use. He wants to use himself as an example, but in order for it to work, he has to remind them somewhat forcefully that he does in fact have this right that he's talking about. So, he's reminding them, don't I have a freedom here? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? This is his reminding them of the event or probably events in his life where Jesus appeared to him personally and has commissioned him to be an apostle. Like the other apostles, he has spoken to Jesus. Jesus has communicated to him the gospel that he is communicating to them. So he's reminding them, that's who I am. I'm someone to whom Jesus has actually spoken. Are you not my work in the Lord? If to others I am not an apostle, yet certainly I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. Now here he's reminding them, not only objectively did Jesus come to me and commission me to do this work, but you of all people ought to know. I mean, this is the kind of the tragic thing about what Paul is saying here is, you of all people ought to know that I am an apostle. You are the seal of my apostleship. I have been among you teaching, doing miracles. Think about what I have brought you, the message that I have brought you, the impact that it has had on this community of people. I have founded this church. You of all people ought to know who I am and that I am one who is giving the gospel. I am one who has the right to be considered a minister of the gospel. Don't you know me? You know who I am, don't you? You know that I am that minister of the gospel, that I am the apostle that I claim to be. You ought to know it. And I do want to emphasize here, though, in saying that you of all people know that I'm an apostle, Paul is not denying the fact that there are those there who dispute it. He knows that, but he's saying to them, you ought to know that I am the apostle that I say that I am. So, he goes on, my defense to those who examine me is this, do we not have a right to eat and drink? Do we not have a right to take along a believing wife, even as the rest of the apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Or do only Barnabas and I have no right to refrain from working? So, he says, my defense to those who examine me is this. And the particular defense that he's making at this point, he's already made the case, look, I'm an apostle, aren't I? Don't I have a certain freedom that goes with the fact that I am called to this role of being an apostle? But some in Corinth are so suspicious of Paul that they're very reluctant to go with the implications of his argument. So he's bringing it out here. Look, this is what I'm saying. I'm an apostle, and that means then that I have a certain right as an apostle. Particularly, don't I have a right to eat and drink? That is, don't I have a right to have a livelihood for the work that I do? Don't I deserve to be supported? Is it that the other apostles, they can even take a believing wife? It's not just themselves, but they have a family as well. And that family goes with them as they minister, and the groups that they go and minister to support them. They feed them. They pay them. They give them what they need to keep their livelihood together. But Paul has not exercised that right with the Corinthians. They have not been paying him. So what he's saying is it that somehow the other apostles have a right to this, but I don't? Is that why I haven't been getting any money from you guys? Because I don't have the right to be supported in what I do? Wouldn't I have the right to have a family as well and to have that family supported because of the work that I'm doing? That's what he's getting at here. Or do only Barnabas and I have no right to refrain from working? Is it only Barnabas and I that have to have a day job to support ourselves so that you're not supporting us? Peter gets to be supported. The other apostles get to be supported. The brothers of the Lord, James and guys like that, they get to be supported. But me and Barnabas, we're not worth it. We have to work. Is that the deal? And what he's saying is no. So his first argument here then is his appeal to the fact that, look, you may not have thought about it, but I'm in the same position that the other ministers of the gospel are here who are supported and their families are supported in the work that they do. I'm no different. So I have the same right to be supported. I have the same freedom to accept money from you for my livelihood while I am helping you, ministering to you by proclaiming the gospel. So, Paul's first argument then concerning his rights as an apostle is an appeal to the precedent of the other apostles. They are exercising this right. They are taking financial support for their families while they are proclaiming the gospel. Don't I have the same right? That's his first argument. Now, he moves on to a second aspect of his argument. Whoever serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat the fruit of it? Or who tends a flock and does not use the milk of the flock? Okay, so I think he's got basically these three analogies from experience. If you think about it, you take a soldier. A soldier is fighting for his country or for perhaps for whomever he might have been hired by, if he's a soldier for hire. He's out there risking his life. He doesn't pay his own way to do that. He's working for his country, for his king, for his employer, whoever, and he doesn't do it at his own expense. He is fed and clothed and taken care of financially while he's doing the work of being that soldier. The person who plants a vineyard expects to eat the fruit of it. I think he has in mind here the one planting the vineyard. Probably he has in mind, again, someone who has been hired to do this, someone who is out actually doing the labor of planting the vineyard. Isn't it true that when someone is planting a vineyard, you have people out there planting, that they are fed while they're doing it, that they receive compensation for the work that they do, and they're planting in the vineyard, there's this expectation that they're going to reap from what comes from the vineyard. I mean, that's the way it works. It only makes sense. Out in the world, someone's working for you to plant stuff in your vineyard, you give them some of the produce from it. That's the way it works. And likewise, someone tending a flock, you don't expect that they're going to tend that flock and then not make use of the milk that comes from the flock. I mean, again, as we look around in the world, we have this expectation that when you do work, you receive the benefit of having done the work. That's the way we do things. I make my livelihood by being a soldier or planting a vineyard or tending a flock, and I share in the product that comes from that. My livelihood is taken care of because I'm doing that work. Now, Paul wants to continue on this idea and bring in a biblical example, which he does. I am not speaking these things according to human judgment, am I? Or does the law not also say these things? For in the law of Moses it is written, "You shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing." It is not oxen that are of concern to God, is it? Or is he speaking for our sake entirely? Yes, it was written for our sake, because the one who plows ought to plow in hope, and the one threshing in hope of sharing in the crop. Okay, so he says that he's not speaking these things according to human judgment. The analogies that he has just used, he's saying I'm arguing from experience that things work in this way, but we can see that this is the way God intends things to be as well. Think about what it says in the law. You shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing. So you have this picture. The ox is yoked to a wheel that is turning around and grinding the grain. And it was a common practice for people to put a muzzle on the ox so that the ox can't eat any of the grain that it is threshing while it is going around. Well, in the Mosaic law, there was a law that says you can't muzzle the ox. When the ox is out there walking around, turning the wheel, grinding the grain, you have to keep the muzzle off so the ox can eat some of the grain while it's working. That's what the law said. Now, Paul says then, it is not oxen that are of concern to God, is it? Now, in earlier days, I got a little too rambunctious, I think, with this verse. In the New American Standard, it's translated, "God is not concerned about oxen, is he?" And I decided that it sounded like what Paul was saying is, God has no concern for animals, does he? And I thought that, well, this is a verse to use against, you know, animal rights people and all that kind of stuff. God doesn't care about animals. He only cares about people. Well, I think that's taking what Paul says too far here. My translation was, it is not oxen that are of concern to God, is it? I think what he's saying is, when you look at that commandment, even though it's talking about oxen, it's not really about oxen, ultimately. There's something more at stake in that command than just taking care of the ox. I think that's what Paul is getting at. What he's saying is, when God said this, he didn't say it because his primary concern was oxen. No, this is about people. Because if you think about the situation, there's something kind of greedy and unfair about putting the ox to work for you, having it grinding out your grain, and yet being too cheap to let it share some of it while it's eating. And so I think it is for the benefit of the ox. I mean, there's a real ox there and it's getting to eat, so in that sense it's about the ox. But the deeper picture of that is the idea of being so grasping, so intent on keeping everything that you can in the world, that you withhold from those who are helping you to gain the products of that gain. They're working on my behalf, but I'm going to keep everything that I've got. I think that's the picture that law is intended to address. That there is something appropriate for the one who is working to have the expectation that they are going to be compensated for their work. And that's what he goes on to say. Or is he speaking entirely for our sake? Yes, it was written for our sake, because the one who plows ought to plow in hope, and the one threshing in hope of sharing in the crop. It's right and appropriate that the one who's doing the work would have this hope of sharing in the results of the product of the crop. So the law is not just about oxen. It is implying that there would be something wrong about having someone, a person, working for my benefit and yet being too greedy to share with them, given that I have benefited from what they have done. I think that's the idea. So then, Paul goes on, if we sowed spiritual things in you, is it too much if we should reap material things from you? If others share the right for your support, do we not more? And so Paul brings it down to himself. Look, I have been working on your behalf like a worker in the field, sowing spiritual benefits among you. I have been explaining the gospel, proclaiming the gospel, helping you to see the road to life and what life is all about. I have been giving you some of the most important things that anyone could receive from someone else. Isn't it appropriate? Would it be a big deal if you were to share material benefits with me, that you would help me to keep myself alive, that you would contribute to my livelihood, given that I have been contributing to you in this way? You extend that right to others. So, aren't I the one who founded this church? In some ways, aren't I the one that to whom you owe the most in that sense? So isn't it even more appropriate that I would share in the physical benefits, that you would take care of my livelihood? So basically Paul is saying to them, look, it is appropriate. There is something right and appropriate about someone who is working on your behalf, as I have been working on your behalf, for you to share and help to maintain my livelihood in the world. There's something right and appropriate. There would be something inappropriate, like muzzling the ox, if you were to withhold from someone who is working on your behalf what they need for their livelihood. Nevertheless, we did not make use of this right, but rather we endure all things in order that we might create no obstacle to the gospel of Christ. Now, this verse introduces the theme that is going to take up the second half of the chapter. He's saying, I could have asked for your financial support, but I worked instead on my own and supported myself, enduring all things, so that I would create no obstacle to the gospel of Christ. What sort of obstacle is he getting at? This is what we'll talk about next time. This is where the second half comes in. I did not exercise this right, and here's why I didn't, and here's what I think you should conclude from that. That's what we'll talk about next time. But here's where he introduces that idea. I have the right, but I didn't use it, and there's a reason I didn't use it. And we'll talk about that reason next time. But he has one more thing to say, one more piece of evidence to bring in to talk about the right that he would have to their financial support. He says, do you not know that those who perform sacred services eat the food from the temple, and the ones serving the altar share what is on the altar? In the same way also, the Lord gave instructions to the ones proclaiming the gospel to make their living from the gospel. Okay, I think Paul is alluding not to the pagan temples here, but actually to the temple in Jerusalem. I think the same thing would be true in the pagan temples, but he's pointing to this because this is evidence of God's design. God himself set things up this way. The Levites live off of the offerings that come to the temple, and this is by God's instruction. This is how God set it up. They're not mooching off the temple. This is what God instructed them to do. Everyone in Israel knows that when they bring an offering to God, they are at the same time supporting those who serve at the temple, serve them at the temple. So this is an example of God's intention that those who serve God and serve the community be paid for their efforts. And then he wraps it up by getting very specific. He says, the Lord gave instructions that the ones proclaiming the gospel make their living from it. This is the way God set it up. I'm telling you, this is God did not intend ministers of the gospel to, as a general rule, go out and work some other job trying to support themselves while they try to minister the gospel at the same time. It was God's instructions to those. This is the way God wants us to do it, is for those who minister the gospel to make their living from it. And that's what I understand Paul to be saying. This is okay with God. He likes this picture that the community that benefits from the proclamation of the gospel contribute to the livelihood of the one who is making that proclamation. This is the way God set it up. Okay, so the summary of Paul's argument here, as I understand it, is basically three parts. First of all, in spite of the opinion of my opponents in Corinth, I am a true apostle, and I have the same right to be paid as the other apostles have exercised. They do it, and I have the same right. Secondly, it is wrong not to pay the one who is working on your behalf. Experience suggests this, and the law of Moses confirms it. And three, the temple shows God's intention that those who serve him be paid by the community. And in fact, this is what he has instructed us to do. He has instructed those who proclaim the gospel to make their living from the gospel. And those who receive that ministry are therefore to contribute towards that livelihood. That's what Paul says. Now, I want you to remind you that we're waiting for the other shoe to drop here. Paul is going to make the case that he does not accept money from them and why he doesn't. And that's really the focus of his argument. I mean, he's saying all of this only so he can put it aside. And next week we're going to see him put it aside. He's not trying to convince them to pay him. He's trying to convince them that he had the right to be paid and didn't exercise it. And in the next week we'll talk about the not exercising it part, because that's the part that he's really concerned with. But just as in the first argument, there is a genuine case that you can make. God is one. There are no idols. Meat sacrificed to idols is nothing. So here, Paul can make the argument, I am truly an apostle. Those who minister the gospel have a right to be supported. There is nothing immoral or wrong with them accepting money from those to whom they minister. In fact, there would be something wrong for someone not to respond to contribute to the livelihood of someone who is working so hard on their behalf. Yet, the important point is, having that right, I didn't exercise it, and I want to explain to you why I didn't exercise it and why that's important. And we'll talk about that next time. But I want to talk about this morning this first part of his argument, his assertion that he has this right to be supported by them. I'm going to ask your indulgence this morning, and I'm particularly going to ask the indulgence of Jack, because this is really unfair to him. But I found myself thinking a lot as I was thinking about this, about an article that Jack wrote a number of years ago. It was 1995, Jack. We're really getting old. I thought, was it a couple years ago? And I looked it up. It was 1995. This is... Pause for a moment of personal clarity that I'm not looking for. Okay. So Jack wrote this article, and I wanted to talk just for a minute about what he said there and how I would relate that to what is being said here. And this isn't entirely fair to Jack, and I hope at the question point he will step in and straighten me out on what I'm doing here. But here, let me recount to you the argument that Jack made, and I want to relate. It seems to me that it gives us some helpful categories to think about this, and I want to put it together here. Okay, Jack's argument, as I understand it, would be something like this. He was working in 1 Thessalonians and saw there Paul talking about our obligation to work with our own hands and contribute to our own livelihood. Basically, that we have an obligation not to be a burden to other people. We are to take care of ourselves. There is something wrong about, for whatever reason, putting myself in a situation where I expect others to do for me what I will not do for myself, and that is take care of myself. Okay? And then Jack applies that teaching to those in ministry and asks some questions about what implications does that have for me in particular, and naturally, since I'm in a very similar position to Jack, I can't help looking at it and thinking, and what implications does this have for me in particular when I think about being a teacher who depends to a certain extent on the contributions, the financial contributions of other people. Jack says there are three possible grounds for supporting someone in ministry. The first one, he says, is gratitude. And I'm going to describe what these mean. At this point, don't blame Jack for what it is I'm about to say. I'm probably not understanding him right. This is my recounting of what it says. But the three points are gratitude. I am so grateful for what someone has done in imparting the gospel to me, because the gospel means a lot to me, that I give a gift to the person who has benefited me. The second category, he says, is patronage, where I become a patron of the gospel. I'm so committed to the importance of the gospel that I see someone who is working to proclaim the gospel and I decide to become a supporter, just like I would be a patron of the arts or something. I want this message to get around. I want this person's work to be seen, and so I'm going to become their patron and contribute to their work. And then the third grounds would be charity. I see that the minister is in need, and I help them out. And Jack's argument is that, and I think this is right, it is wrong for someone who preaches the gospel to deliberately put himself in the position where he relies on other people's charity. That is, it is not wrong to be charitable. It is not wrong to see someone in a needy situation and give to them. But what would be wrong is for me to not work on my own behalf and expect other people to take care of me. I have a responsibility to work on my own behalf. So it's appropriate for the minister to accept gifts of gratitude. It is appropriate for the minister to accept patronage on behalf of the gospel. It would be wrong to put other people in a situation where I am forcing them to take care of needs that I am not taking care of myself. That's how I understood what Jack was saying. So how does that relate to what it is that I said here this morning? Again, don't blame this on Jack. I'm not entirely sure that I understand if I've gotten the categories right, and I may be misunderstanding what he had in mind there. But I'm going to borrow those categories, and in borrowing those categories, I would like to suggest that there are not three but four possible grounds for contributing to someone in ministry. Charity would be one of them. I see that the minister is in need, and out of love, I help out. The love part is great. I agree with Jack that we do not want to be presumptuous and deliberately throw ourselves on the mercy of other people. Everyone has an obligation to work toward their own livelihood, and I agree with what Jack's saying. Gratitude, I agree with that. I give a gift out of gratitude for what I have benefited by in the gospel. Patronage, I become a supporter to help further the message of the gospel, trying to foster that message's growth and extension around. But if I understand those categories, and I may not be, I think we have to add one more category. If I am understanding what Paul's saying here, and I invite you all to tell me I'm not understanding what Paul's saying here, but it seems to me that the category that we see in the section I just talked about is obligation. A minister has been working on my behalf, and it is not appropriate to muzzle the ox. Forgetting the unflattering comparison in that analogy. If I understand what Paul is saying, he's saying that experience and the law say that there would be something wrong with me if I were to not recognize that someone has been working on my behalf and compensate them for it. Now, maybe that comes under the category of gratitude. I'm grateful for what a person has done for me, and this is so fine. Maybe that's the same thing, except the concept of gratitude in my mind sort of has that sense of no obligation. That is, I didn't have to do this, but I was so grateful for what you did that I freely decided I was going to do it anyway. I think Paul is suggesting that there is a certain level of obligation, that it would be like hiring someone to fix my roof and then not paying them if I did not recognize what someone who teaches the gospel has contributed to me and recognize a certain obligation on my part. So I don't know whether Jack would agree with that or whether they fit in with his categories, but as far as I can see, that's what Paul is suggesting here, that there's not just that I had the right to accept your patronage, but the fact is it is wrong to muzzle the ox. The fact is you ought to see your obligation to support someone who is working on your behalf. Now, if that's right, then it seems to me that there is an implication both for the minister and those who are ministered to. For the minister, I can be obedient to the command that Paul gives in 1 Thessalonians about working with my hands and not have a day job, because there is nothing wrong with accepting payment for the work that the teacher does as a minister of the gospel. Digging a ditch and proclaiming the gospel are equally dignified work, as I would understand what Paul is saying. That if I have no problem accepting payment for digging the ditch or plowing the field, then I equally have no problem with accepting payment for having been a teacher and proclaimer of the gospel. There's nothing presumptuous about seeing a certain appropriateness in that situation. That's the way God intended it to be. And for those who are ministered to, gratitude is great, patronage is great, even charity is great on our side of things as those who receive teaching and deal with those who minister to us. Even charity in their time of need is an appropriate thing. But it seems to me that Paul is suggesting that on our side of things that we ought to recognize a certain obligation, that it would be mean-spirited and unfair of us to benefit from someone who is working on our behalf and not see an obligation to compensate them for it. Those who work for me deserve to be paid. I think that's what Paul is saying. Now, having said that, I want to qualify what I have just said in a couple ways. First of all, Paul is equally against what he later calls peddling the gospel. People can see the gospel as a means of making themselves wealthy. And in particular, if it's going to be a means for making me wealthy, I had better make sure that I make it attractive. When you're in sales, you have to have a good product. So I need to make sure that I craft a gospel that is going to get me the most gratitude and recognition that I can out there. Paul argued that that's not what he did, that the fact is that most of the people he talked to wrote him off, and yet he continued to proclaim the gospel honestly and for what it is, because he would not peddle it. He was not going to turn it into his source of livelihood in the sense that he was going to shape it and make it more salable. I'm going to give it straight, and I'm going to live with the consequences. Unfortunately, as I look around the world around us, I see too many times people who, it seems to me, are peddling the gospel, that they have found a way of making themselves wealthy by putting together a message that people like to hear. Some of them are obvious. Some of them are just turn on the TV and look at them, and your BS meter goes off the scale, and you say, okay, well, I know what we're looking at here. Sometimes it's a little harder to tell, but okay. Secondly, I want to qualify this by saying it would be totally wrong, I think, for those in ministry to dictate to others how they are to use their money. Here's where the model of being paid for your labor kind of breaks down. Because it's not that there's a set fee. In one sense, the value of what we receive from those who accurately present the gospel to us and its implications is greater than we could pay. So on the one hand, it's worth whatever you could pay for it. But on the other hand, God doesn't intend it to have that sort of monetary place in our lives. We have many obligations to our families, to support ourselves and keep ourselves from needing charity from other people and so on. So how a person works out their obligation to support themselves, to support their family, to contribute to other things they might feel are worthy, and to meet their obligation to those who work on their behalf in proclaiming the gospel, that seems to me to be each person's individual place to work out. And it would be entirely inappropriate to dictate, I think it would be inappropriate to dictate that. All I'm saying is that Paul says we have such an obligation, if I'm understanding what he's saying. And then lastly, I want to just make a little personal comment here. I know that this is a strange kind of message for me to be proclaiming. I feel a little bit uncomfortable. I have felt a little uncomfortable as I'm talking about this, because if I inspire you with my message this morning, I'm liable to benefit financially. And so it's like, you know, so do I really pour it on and start pounding the pulpit here? I don't want to do that. So I wanted to just make a comment as I'm ending about how I think personally about what I'm saying here. First of all, the reason I'm saying it is because we got to this spot in 1 Corinthians, and I think this is what Paul is saying. And if it's not what Paul is saying, I would be happy to be convinced otherwise. I didn't say this because it was a message that I approve of on my own financial behalf. I just think this is what Paul is saying. Secondly, I hope that our experience together would be evidence that we teachers around here do not tend, I hope, to put pressure on people to give money. I hope that our history together would convince you that I'm not trying to twist your arm here. Thirdly, I have no complaints. I'm not here to accuse anyone of misusing their money or not meeting their obligations. I'm not here to say you need to do more financially than what you're doing. I just want to tell you what I think Paul is saying here. I would also point out that I'm not just a teacher, but I'm also a beneficiary of the teaching. And so, personally, when I hear this message, I don't think about it so much in terms of your obligation to support me as I think about it in terms of my obligation to support those who have contributed so much to me. So, this is if there's a personal element to this, I feel like it's a message to me and not about me. And then, finally, I would remind you that next week I'm going to come here and explain to you why Paul wouldn't take any money at all, which doesn't help my case if I'm trying to make a fortune off you guys. Okay, so having said all of that stuff, I would really appreciate it if people would step in with some questions. And I don't want to put Jack on the spot, but I would appreciate it if he would say something so I know whether I understood his categories right or not. I don't want to misrepresent you, Jack.
You ended with some personal remarks about this, and so I want to give you some personal remarks too. And I just want to say that how grateful I am that you continue to say things that I know sometimes are uncomfortable for you to say and uncomfortable for us to hear. And you've been doing that for decades in my life, and I appreciate that. And my gratitude goes far beyond that, and the ways in which I'm able to contribute to your support and those of the other staff, it's really nothing in comparison to the gratitude I feel for the blessing that all of you have been in my life and my family's life.
Great. Well,
so thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you.
And I've known you guys for
a long time.
Long time, and I can say that you've never peddled the gospel. And you know, you've supported me when I was able to support you, and when I wasn't able to support you. And I don't often take advantage of the opportunity to express my gratitude to all of you and the staff. So thank you.
Nice.
No, I agree. I think that's a good category. It's an odd category, though,
right.
I would add, because it's not a typical and conventional obligation.
Right.
I think our obligation is to recognize the appropriateness of the support. But it's not an obligation to support per se. It's not a personal obligation between the teacher and the student. It's an obligation before God to recognize what it is that God is doing in their life through another individual and to appreciate the value of that and therefore respond accordingly. I don't know any other obligation quite like that. So it can be misleading to just...
No, I agree. And in fact, I meant to say, I think this is fitting with what you're saying there, Jack. I meant to say that it breaks down at a certain spot, but it breaks down if I am a plumber and I go and fix your plumbing and you don't pay me, I have the right to feel gypped in a sense. I mean, like, no, I earned that. It's not the relationship between teachers and those that teach is not the same kind of obligation. I don't have the right to feel gypped because I'm doing it. I mean, Paul is going to go on and say, I mean, his whole concern is that the gospel be proclaimed and that people not have impediments to making the decision to invest their life in the gospel. So that ought to be my concern. I might have a certain sadness if I teach a group of people and they never ever get to the point of thinking about it enough to even wonder whether I need any money or anything like that. But you're right, it's not an obligation like that where something has been agreed on between us and you have to pay that out and I have a right to feel gypped. But the reason I want to put it in those terms, I think, is that's why I said the two things on both sides. For the minister, I don't have the right to expect it, but I don't have to feel guilty about feeling that. There's one thing in your article where you said something about how I could be working hard and that's not the point. I agree with you, it's not the point in a sense, but I can be a holy person. I can be pursuing righteousness, doing what is right, and consider the work that I have been doing in proclaiming the gospel as worthy of having been paid for.
That, yeah. Yeah, I agree. That there were it was a number of years ago, I think it was Oz Guinness, was reporting about some at the time, he didn't name the person, but some well-known, renowned evangelical teacher or something, who, when they were called upon to speak and one went somewhere to speak, they wouldn't go and speak unless they would fly them their first class.
Right.
And it seems to me that they've crossed over a line where they are looking at this obligation in the same way that a plumber or any sort of professional would, that I've got a fee, I will come, I will work, you can hire me, but I expect to be compensated in the way that I expect to be compensated.
Absolutely.
And that's, yeah, that I just think that's wrong. Paul's motivation is to see the change in the lives of people. That is his joy. That is his glory. That's all the thanks he needs. He doesn't, on top of that, need financial obligation to make it worthwhile for him to be his compensation. But on the other hand, you're absolutely right. If I withhold material support from somebody who's given me life through the message of the gospel out of my greed, I've got a problem with God. That's not, you don't have a problem with the teacher, but you do have a problem with God.
Yeah.
At that point.
No, that's great, Jack. And I don't mean to downplay the importance. Believe me, in our culture, ministers of the gospel are not in danger of making too little of their rights to be paid. I mean, that's not where the danger lies. It all lies on the other side. So I didn't say this to try to somehow make it easier for us to go out and fleece everyone. I mean, it's just, but I do think what Paul wanted to convince them of is, when I, as an apostle, am thinking about how I exercise my rights, don't kid yourself that I wouldn't have had the right, that there would have been something wrong for me to take money from you, because it would be appropriate. God says it would be appropriate for you to pay and for me to take it. Nothing wrong with that scenario. That's why it's significant that I didn't choose to do it. Anything else?
I have two questions. One of them has to do with, it's sort of unrelated, but he brings in here, he talks about, I am an apostle, and he says, I have seen Christ. Is that sort of a requirement for someone who's an apostle? I mean, if you're going through and thinking about, you know, who is an apostle, what kind of categories does he think of when he thinks of an apostle?
Yeah. That's a tricky question. I know that people use this verse to indicate this was their conception. There are certain qualifications for the job, and nobody would be qualified for the job if they hadn't seen Jesus. And they put this together with the scene at the beginning of Acts where Judas is out, and so they're choosing another apostle from among people who had been traveling with Jesus, so that they were in the same kind of situation. That's possible, but I don't think that's necessarily the idea. The idea is, an apostle is one who is sent out with the authority of the one who's sending him out. He can speak in his name. So, yes, the idea is, who is qualified to say, this is what Jesus said, this is what his message is about, and so on. I think Paul is alluding more to his qualifications. When he says, have I not seen Jesus our Lord, there are a lot of people who saw Jesus who are still not qualified to be apostles, but he saw him in a particular way, in that Jesus appeared to him, called him to do what he's doing. So I think he's reminding them of, you know, what he says so often in his letters. You know, I didn't make this up. I didn't appoint myself an apostle. Jesus came to me and said, this is what you're going to do. So I'm sort of more inclined to see him saying, on my side of it, I am one who has seen Jesus. You know that story. You know the story, I mean, you know, Damascus Road and visions and all this stuff. So he doesn't just mean seeing him. He means seeing him in the way I saw him, I think. But it's debatable.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a second question, you said?
Yeah, I guess on the second part where he talks about the temple and the different things, it was the practice of the Israelites to pay a 10% tithe in their system to the service temple, to the temple service and things like that. Do you think Paul is pulling in they are mentioning the temple, that sort of a relationship where I mean, you see, I guess Abraham gave 10% to Melchizedek, and oftentimes people talk about a tithe being 10%, things like that. And what's your thoughts on that, and how that sort of an example given in the Old Testament Israel is to be understood by us?
Yeah. Well, I guess there's two parts to that. The first part is here, the way I understand his language, I don't think he's emphasizing the tithe aspect of it. He's emphasizing the whole idea is the sharing in. That is, there are, what would happen is some of the food that is offered to God is in fact eaten by the Levites. So if he's alluding to any particular practice, I think it's that, because it's that idea of some of what has come into the temple that was intended for God is being given to the Levites. What the practice of the tithe, the idea of the 10%, the model of Abraham and the tithe in the Old Testament, how that relates to what we ought to do now, that gets into that larger picture of what sort of relationship is there between the ritual practices of Israel and what the practices of a righteous person should be. And as is probably no surprise to you, I tend to lean in the direction that much of the specifics of the rituals that Israel involved themselves in, that they were given not to say the righteous person does this particular practice, but it was intended to exemplify something. So I think that, as with many of the practices that they had, that what it points to is our obligation to see what we have been given as coming from God, and that I need to use it to turn it back and use it in the service of God. As a practical matter, I know people who have found it helpful to do the tithe thing for their own sake as kind of a personal reminder. I need to remember that my resources come from God and they are not just for my own amusement. But I don't think we have a moral obligation to follow 10%. I think we have a moral obligation to follow the model of using our resources toward the things of God. Thank you. Next week I'll tell you why I shouldn't take any of your money.